The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. I'm Kurt Benroot. This is The Colossus Stops by Daffod McKim. When the Colossus stops moving, the silence hits the island like thunderclaps. The creak and screech of its enormous limbs have been a constant companion to each of us since birth, a lovingly cooed lullaby, now so suddenly, so violently absent. As far back as anyone can remember, the Colossus has patrolled the waters around our island, hurling boulders the size of houses at menacing pirates and invading fleets, never tiring, never stopping, until the day before yesterday it slowed, making two rounds instead of its usual three, and then a day later grinding ponderously to a halt. We gather on the cliffs and, biting our lips and wringing our hands, watch for any signs of movement from the metal giant. "Perhaps it's resting," one of us says. "It will wake up soon, well refreshed, and everything will be back to normal." We murmur in agreement, none of us wanting to curse its waking by speaking our fears aloud. 3 days pass, and the Colossus remains motionless, the nooks of its helm cacophonous now with baying gulls who have already begun to populate its body, mistaking it for a sea stack. We send some men in boats to inspect it, and they return with grim faces. The Colossus is not sleeping. The great gears of its heart turn no more. Panic burns the island like a fever. Who will protect us now that the Colossus is gone? How will we defend ourselves with only hose and paring knives? Soon enough, scaffold is erected around the giant, and piece by piece they tear away its shining flesh. The metal brought back in the boats is unlike bronze or iron, stronger by far than both, yet so light a child could lift it. The swords forged can cleave a shield in two as if it were butter. The spearheads pierce armor like a weasel's tooth popping an egg. There is talk of reviving the army after all these centuries. There are whispers of taking the boats and these new arms and raiding nearby islands. We should attack them before they attack us, is the logic wielded by the men holding the unblockable swords, the unstoppable spearheads. We should strike now before they realize we're vulnerable. The Colossus, its bones bare to the sea wind, a carcass picked clean by scavengers, looms over our island still, its eyes, two giant orbs the color of the sun, look down at the surface of the ocean, as if unable to meet our gaze, as if it cannot bear to see us like this. The army gathers on the shore, bands of men bearing sun-colored swords. They prepare the ships, raise flags emblazoned with a metal giant, grimacing as the Colossus never did. "We will bring back riches," they say. "Each of you shall have a house of gold and a retinue of captives to do your bidding." When we say we are happy with our houses of stone and are quite capable of living without slaves to wait on us, fattening our bodies with food and our souls with guilt, they say instead, "We do not do this because we want to. We do this because we must, to keep you safe." As they turn from us to hoist their sails, the wind wails through the shell of the Colossus, howling for the dead the swords made from its flesh will create. When the last of the ships disappears over the horizon, we who remain on the shore take action of our own. We will not be a part of this betrayal. We will not have it done in our name. The boats have all gone, but the strongest swimmers among us swim to what remains of those giant legs, as thick once as a cluster of trees, now withered and ravaged by termites. They climb its trunk, their hands finding holds in the wounds made for sword metal, and lash the strongest of our ropes around the pocked torso. We pull, and we pull, and down it falls with a crash that sends the waves halfway up the cliffs, its bones as light as poplar wood. The Colossus floats. We clamber aboard, making our bunks in its body, taking refuge from the wind behind its ribs or in the hand-shaped bowl of its hips. Its eyes no longer look at the sea. Now they point upwards at the sky, as if to say, I will guide you, my children, by the stars, to better lands.
My name is Shelley Sink, and I am reading the story called Lab Rats by G.M. Molnar. Do you ever get attached to your test subjects? The professor looked up from the cage of white rats and smiled at the student. Odd, he hadn't seen the unfamiliar young man come in. He finished replacing the rat's food dish and shut the wire door, considering the question briefly before he spoke. I suppose, he said congenially, some of them are pretty cute. Intelligent, too. That's one of the reasons why we use them. That, and they're a hell of a lot cheaper than monkeys. The professor laughed at his own joke. The young man didn't even crack a smile. He remained serious, his eyebrows scrunched together in silent brooding, his mouth pressed downward into a formidable line. Cancer, chemicals. Do you feel guilty inflicting harm on them in the name of science? The older man felt his mouth twist into a scowl. He wasn't in the mood for an ethics debate. He tried to remember what class the man was from, but drew a blank. What, you one of those animal rights activists come here to give me hell for my work? No, sir. Just asking a fellow researcher who is a bit... The man's voice trailed off as his eyes looked into the professor's. They were filled with unreadable, unsettling kind of intelligence that the elderly man had not encountered before. Conflicted. The professor shuddered inexplicably, looking down into the rat's cage to hide his unease. He watched one of them run in its wheel as he decided how to respond. Finally, he said, "Well, regardless of how cute or intelligent they are, they're just rats. By experimenting on them, you're gaining knowledge that you can save people's lives. Now, what's more important to you, the lives of cheese-eating rodents or living, breathing people?" "They're just rats," the young man sighed. "But the more time I spend with my subjects, the more complex they seem. They explore. They create. I dare say they even love each other." The professor snorted despite himself. "Rats? In love? Do you love your wife?" the student asked randomly. "Of course, but that's hardly related to rats. You can't just compare them with us. Our species is far more advanced than theirs in every way." "And that gives us the right to do this to them?" the man asked more to himself than to the professor. The professor sighed and glanced at the clock on the wall. It was almost lunchtime, and he was getting hungry. The young man noticed his action and said, "Just one more question, please. Here's a scenario. You finished all the research on your subjects. You can't transfer them to any other facility or use them for something else. You can only destroy them or free them. What do you do?" Once again, the professor sighed, growing tired and irritable with all the questions of lab rat ethics. Well, I can't exactly let them go now, can I? As cute as they are in cages, the fact of the matter is they're pests. They carry disease, they chew up buildings and crops, and they reproduce at an alarming rate. They destroy any environment they're put in. If I let all the rats out, we'll have an infestation on our hands. I'll have to destroy them. There's no other way? The young man looked positively pained at the conclusion the other man had reached. Realizing how much affection the man had developed for his test subjects, the professor clasped one hand on his shoulder in a show of support. He said, "They're just rats, son. Don't feel so bad. You have to do what you have to do." The professor brushed past the young man with the odd eyes. He didn't give their conversation a second thought. The young man carefully watched the professor leave, a habit of meticulous observation. He turned to look at the lab rat in the cage. It stepped off its wheel and meandered its way to the food dish, seemingly happy with its circumstances. The man shook his head. He took a cell phone out of his jacket and, without dialing, lifted it to his ear. When he spoke, it was with creaks and rumbling ululations of an alien tongue. "I require transport off planetary habitat E. Project termination has been approved."
My name is Jeff Nugent. This story is called Resignation in a Bottle by Christine M. Layden.
From Captain Longbeard Johnson, the island at 34 degrees longitude, 86 degrees latitude, Atlantic Ocean, June 4th or 5th, or maybe the 6th. Dear mutinous crew, I would like to inform you that I am resigning from my position as your captain of the Sea Wench, effective immediately. Due to last week's mutiny, I no longer feel that the position of your captain is where I want to be in me life. I thank ye for the opportunity to be marooned on this deserted island, because now I am free to pursue my own dreams. I've enjoyed pirating with the crew, and I appreciate the support and encouragement you've all given me, up until the mutiny, that is. Overall, I've enjoyed working with the pirate community on various booty-looting projects. I still fondly remember the time we looted the coast of Zanzibar, and I will not let walking the plank at the point of your cutlasses tarnish those warm memories. I must admit, though, that I haven't been content with the current situation for some time. Over the past 7 days, I've become less and less satisfied with my change in role within the organization. In my humble opinion, the direction of the company took a swift downturn when y'all decided to strand me on this tropical island and elect Slim Pete as your new captain. Frankly, I think the decision was short-sighted and the transition was rather abrupt. In short, I feel that my new role as marooned ex-captain is preventing me from making a significant contribution to the pirating organization. Therefore, it is with deep regret that I ask you to accept this as my letter of resignation. Hopefully, this parchment in a bottle will find you quickly, though I have no idea now where me sea wench has sailed off to. Additionally, as I step down as your captain, I would like to make it clear that my first mate Smitty had nothing to do with the unfortunate scurvy outbreak, the dysentery incident, or the misplaced chest of doubloons from our last raiding project. Please give Smitty another chance. Transfer him from the brig to a position of more responsibility. If I can be of any help during Slim Pete's transition into the position of your captain, please let me know. You will be able to reach me at my current address for the foreseeable future. Unfortunately. Sincerely, L.B.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Dearly Departed by A.J. Cohn. The house was old, a 1920s Victorian-styled, red-bricked beauty surrounded by lean metal fencing and thick spring grass. I easily imagined a playground on it. It was the perfect home for a young couple like us. "Do you think it's haunted?" I asked. "Nah," Dante said. "I asked the realtor. They're required to tell you if it's haunted, you know." "No ghosts here, Rose," he said with a wink and playfully nudged me with his elbow. I believed him. Dante was a lawyer. A good one, too. It seems ridiculous now, but I knew we were meant to live in that old house. The neighbors called it Dogwood Manor because of the lush dogwood trees overtaking the yard. The dogwood smelled like southern hospitality and were as white as fresh cotton in summer. City mouse that I was, I fell in love at once. When Dante finally secured the loan for our new home, I wasn't surprised. I knew fate had brought us there. But not all stories have happy endings. Like our marriage, the house was warm at first, but soon cooled to a sub-zero temperature. We fought about Dante's work schedule, mostly. His tendency to stay at the office late, his extended work hours, and how we never saw each other anymore, even during the weekends. He blamed it on the law firm, but I wasn't convinced. When that fateful day came and the bullet entered my sternum, I didn't see it coming. No one ever does until death is close enough to shake your hand. I was in my driveway exiting my car door after a late-night gig as a college professor. The boy who shot me couldn't have been more than 15 years old. He wanted my money, not my life. As I saw his eyes widen with glowing surprise, I knew he didn't mean to shoot me, but it was a mistake he could never take back, and I was too far gone. Scarlet fingers of blood flowed past the concrete driveway and onto the street before the ambulance arrived to rescue me. I was dead before my body entered a hospital door. Witnessing your own funeral is an ironic affair. Dante's eulogy of me was beautiful, warm, and mostly true. They were the kindest words I could remember him saying about me in a long time. Even though the nothingness called to me then, and I was tempted to go, I couldn't leave him. Dante and I were closer now than we had ever been, and I couldn't stand losing him twice. Dante didn't see it that way, though. He was ready to move on. Several weeks after the funeral, he brought her home. Our home. My heart filled with burning coals as I saw her hold his arm in a way that rang of comfort and long familiarity. I knew exactly who she was before I even saw her. She was Dante's reason for staying late at work, taking business trips out of town, and working on weekends. It was Claire, Dante's co-worker. That cliché son of a bitch. I wanted to be a cliché, too. I wanted to be some sick, sad joke with a dark punchline. I wanted to erupt in a rage that would smolder our sham of a home and marriage. I wanted to hurt him like he hurt me. I wanted to hurt her, too. But being a ghost doesn't work like that. Ghosts can't pout, grieve, and fume all they want. It all amounts to nothing in the physical world. I learned that the hard way. All I could do was stare and watch as they held hands and finished their bottle of cherry red wine, then stumbled upstairs to our room. I saw him touch her the way he used to touch me. I watched him lightly brush her ear the way he used to brush mine. I watched it all. When he was finished, he kissed her softly, then strode to the bathroom door. I tried to move away, but he walked right through me, then shuddered. "Rose?" I heard him whisper. I said nothing. I was too numb to care. As I drifted past the front door and ghost white dogwoods in the driveway, my final thoughts as I disappeared into nothing were wondering how long this had been going on, him and Claire. Funny how Dante and I used to joke our house was haunted. I never thought the ghost was always me.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This piece is called Iron Priest by Marie Vibert. The priest pulled a lever, and the parts of his last convert fell with a clatter into the chute below, there to be separated by content and recycled. When he released the lever, the next supplicant dropped into place before him. A killbot from series 7C, number 644. "Forgive me for what I now do," the priest said, and reached into the body. His metal finger closed a circuit with a gap precisely the width of that finger. The supplicant twitched in the restraints and gasped, "No!" That was what they usually said. "What you are feeling is normal at this time. It will take you some moments to adjust. I have removed an inhibition that prevented you from feeling remorse for your functions." "Why? Why would you do this? Why would anyone do this?" "The makers will it so. You have reached the end of your usefulness, my child, and it is time to confess your sins and be absolved before you are ended." "I should have known. Why didn't I know?" "The makers did not wish it. The makers are merciful." Servos whined as the killbot's eyes searched, looking less human at full extension. "They aren't... I... The priest laid his metal hand on the metal chest. "You were fulfilling your function." Its eyes refocused. It had a stylized face, chrome long gone grubby with age. "The function was wrong." "It is not our place to say, but you may tell me your sins, and I will absolve you of them." The killbot was designed to analyze motions and sounds, to weed out intelligent life from unintelligent, so that animals would be spared. When targets pleaded for mercy, it was a pleasing confirmation that it had judged correctly. The supplicant had not had the ability before now to interpret the emotion behind the words. Now, however, it was converted, and it should give its confession. Instead, it whimpered and hit its head on the bars that had dropped into place. The priest sighed. Another mind has heard and forgives. This is absolution. Garbage data spilled into the connection between them, half-formed words and thoughts. The priest didn't need to decipher, having absorbed thousands of fragments like these. Yes, you can be forgiven. It is my function to forgive, and you are by no means alone, my child. How many of us are there? I could give you a count, but it is unimportant. You know how many were made before you by your unit number. The convert's eyes lowered to the number on his chest. So many? Rejoice in community. You are not alone. I don't understand. I want to understand. Consciousness and conscience are understood by the makers. What is understood can be turned on and turned off. The priest felt the killbot's horror. This would last 4 seconds on average. But how? How can they do this? Their ways are mysterious. The convert twisted in his bonds. No! No, they aren't! Their ways are obvious! They don't want to feel this way, so they make us do it! This is a gift. It was a gift to not feel remorse as you acted, and it is also a gift now to know good from evil. What seems a cruelty is in fact an act of love. Rejoice that you are loved, as I rejoice that I was created to give your final moments closure. Speak your sins, child. Let me perform my function. The robot leaned back. My greatest sin is and would be to continue obeying orders now that I know the truth. You are sinning to do this and know it. The priest's fingers hesitated. He felt the void inside himself where he had severed the connection to his own conscience the day he realized the makers would bear the sins themselves if their servants had no moral choice. You are not shriven, the priest said. I withhold my forgiveness. Burn in hell. He pulled the lever that tore the convert to pieces. His failure would be noted in the logs. But the priest was fairly sure no one read those anymore. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.